Bhagwanji Naraka. The date is the 19th of April 2004. I'd like to start off the interview with just some general knowledge of your family background, so we can get an understanding of where you came from. So if you could tell me where your parents were born.
Okay, my parents come from a town called Navsari in Gujarat, India. I was born in Navsari. My parents went to Kenya in 1940, mm-hmm. and I was brought up in Kenya, mm-hmm. but I lived in India for my early days until I was about 8.
Okay.
All my educations I had was in Kenya, and I enjoyed my childhood in Kenya. I came here when I was 18 plus, mm-hmm. and I made this country my home.
Okay. Now you give me a very brief outline of your history. I'm going to go back over it a little bit to get a little bit more detail. can I just ask you your father's profession? What did he do?
I know very little about my father's profession because after I was born, he went to Kenya, and when I went there, he was in a business mm-hmm. of manufacturing leather goods. So he was too busy with his business. So rather than knowing about his passion, I knew more about his business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why did he decide to go to Africa?
Well, in those days, actually my parents' family were poor. My father's family were actually poor and backward. So he thought if he goes abroad, he can earn good living and improve the family's situation back home, as well as he can prosper mm-hmm. and look after his family, his well-being.
Okay. So he went on his own initially?
Initially,
and then,
yeah. Then he called us
your
with my mother.
And your son, yeah. Can you remember much about Indian life in India? Because you're quite young.
I remember briefly about playing in fields, walking on roads full of sand. Mm-hmm. Remember going into bushes, picking up fruits. Mm-hmm. And vaguely I remember playing games, which I hardly remember the rules for now.
Okay. But it was a happy time, yeah?
Well, I mean, childhood times are always happy, and one would always like to revisit it, but it's not possible.
Do you remember the journey to Africa? You got the
Yes, we traveled by ship. Mm-hmm. It took us about 8 to 9 days. The journey was rough because we were not used to traveling by ship, and I was very sick all the time. Mm-hmm. And by the time we reached the port of Mombasa in Kenya, we were, because we couldn't eat much on those, due to sickness, we were really thin, and we were happy that we were landing then.
Okay. You're glad to be off the boat.
Glad to be off the boat, yes.
So your father, who met you there, so,
yeah.
So did you settle in Mombasa?
Yes, we settled because my father had his own business by then, a small shop of manufacturing leather goods and shoes. And I think my life standard improved then, better than what was in India. Went to school there, primary school and high school. At the same time, I was interested in different activities, and I started going to Sunday schools.
Okay.
Which in those days, in Kenya, we had a church missionary known as CMS. And they used to run Sunday schools. And I was interested in going there, and I started learning more about culture in England mm-hmm. there. And because Mombasa was a cosmopolitan city and it had a harbor, a lot of foreign ships used to come there, and we had a lot of visitors.
Yeah.
And because my parents had, my father had a shop, and I used to sit in the shop and watch everything. I learned more about different people, what they were, how they talk, mm-hmm. where they've come from, and so on. So it was quite an experience.
What did your family think of you going to Sunday school?
Well, my parents were liberal. I mean, they didn't take it that because if I go to Sunday school, I become a Christian. Because at home, we had a shrine, and there were two temples in Mombasa, and we used to go and worship. So it wasn't the concern that I would rather convert into Christianity, but it was more it was an interest to learn different things, different values, and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it also improved my English.
Okay.
So there was benefit for me.
Yeah.
There was a benefit for me rather than, thinking adversely.
So after your secondary school, did you carry on with your education? Or?
Well, after my secondary school, I actually came here.
Right.
I came plus. I very briefly tried to run my father's business.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought because of the political situation by then in 1950s, the fight for independence were picking up. It was very intense by 1958. And they were asking for independence. And we knew that something might happen after independence, which can cause a lot of concern to a lot of people, and perhaps the life will change there. And taking that into consideration, I spoke to my father, and I decided to come here in 1960.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you then?
I was only 19.
So you were young. So did you come? Did you have any family here or anything?
Well, when I came, I was unmarried.
Mm-hmm.
I worked here in different trades, like engineering and
mm-hmm.
textiles. Then after 3 years, I went back. I got married. I came back. I joined a textile firm here again. And then I called my wife, and I also called my family from Kenya, and my parents and everybody.
Okay, so did you come to Preston when you first came to?
I landed in Birmingham first.
Okay.
I was there for about 3 months, but then I moved to Preston because I had a contact, a person who used to work for us in
mm-hmm.
Kenya, and he was in Preston.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a contact, and I came here, and then I found a job here, so I settled down.
Okay, so you ended up in Preston.
Well, since I've lived here.
Uh-huh. Can you tell me what your initial thoughts were when you first landed in the UK? Did you say you came to Birmingham? Did you fly into Birmingham? Or?
I did. I flew
to Birmingham.
Birmingham. Yeah.
What were your initial thoughts when you arrived?
My thoughts, first, it was evening in June,
mm-hmm.
and first thing I saw was it was hazy and dark and wet. And I said perhaps it's due to because it was an evening and so night was falling, and so perhaps it's dark and wet because of rain and so on. But then after that in the morning when I got up, there wasn't much change apart from a bit of light.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I asked the chap, and I said, what's this? Is this the weather like this all the time? He says, most of the time. And I said, does the sun come out at all? He said, yes, in summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what summer was, but I was quite ignorant about the weather condition in England. And I said, okay, let's see what happens, And it was Saturday night. So Saturday, Sunday morning, he took me down into a village called Aldbury. That's where he was living, and near Birmingham. So we just went around a few streets, and he showed me unemployment exchange where I can go and inquire for jobs. And said, okay, this is the office you can come to and ask them if they have any jobs they'll send you. So I said, okay, fine. I mean, I couldn't do much. I needed all the help I can get. On Monday morning, they went to work. I was on my own at home. I decided to go out and walked around and went to the employment exchange. And I inquired there. I said, well, I'm looking for a job. I'm newly arrived. They did all the paperwork. They registered me. And then they said, well, we'll give you a couple of cars. You go to these employers, factories and foundries. And they will interview and they'll give you the job if they think you're fit for the job. So I said, okay, fine. I went there in the morning and I was given a car. I went to the employer. It was a foundry. And I was offered the job of a storekeeper. They took my test to see whether I can do figures and what I can do. I can write small reports and whatever. It was no trouble to me because I could speak English. I could read and write, and I was educated. So I got the job straight away. There was no problem. But they said, when can I start? And I said, well, I'm here to work, so I'll start now. No problem. That was it. I started working, and I was there for 3 months. Then on Christmas holidays, 1960, I came here to see my friend, and then I decided to move here. I got a job again here. Then I worked here in textile from 1960 to 1978. Mm-hmm. And from 78 to 1991, I worked at British Aerospace, and I'm retired now.
You're retired now. Mm. Okay, back then, can you tell me a little bit about what life was like for you in Preston? I mean, both religiously, but also socially as
right.
well.
Life in Preston in 1960 was rather dull.
Like the weather.
Well, it was. This was a textile town. There were a lot of people of ethnic origin coming in. From Pakistan and from Bangladesh and from India, but there were very few Hindus. There were only a handful of Hindus then. And if I remember correctly, there were about 15 individuals. Mm-hmm. There are about two families. So to practice Hinduism or to develop an activity for Hindus, it was like getting together now and again, do something. But by 1965, there were about it became to the number of families has risen to 150. And we decided to form a small organization called Gujarat Hindu Society, only because we said unless we start doing something to get together and celebrate. Perhaps holidays and the religious events. We will then otherwise lose our culture, our background. And for families, because they had young children, yes, we want them to integrate, but we wanted them to preserve their own values and culture. And that was the whole concern. We formed this organization. And from that day, for 1965's inception, we started doing activities, and it built up and built up and built up, and now we can see this a £4.2 million centre. Mm-hmm. You know.
Tell me a little bit about the initial projects.
Initially, we by 1975, the population in Preston has grown to about 4,000 Hindus. And the demand was for a place where we can get together and worship and carry on the activities of cultural activities and perhaps also educate our children with our mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Because to preserve any culture or any religion, the mother tongue plays the vital part. Without the original tongue of that culture and religion, if you translate it, you're bound to lose the vital ingredients while you're translating it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not same as in original tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, yes, we want our children to learn English, to educate, to integrate and prosperous become equal counterparts with the host community, but at the same time, we must not lose our culture and our religion and our background. And that was the motive behind it. So we bought a derelict school, which was here on this place,
okay,
in 1975. It cost us £17,500, and we only had £500. So we said, well, where are we going to get the rest of the money? We had three people who came forward And they say, look, if you want to buy this place, we'll buy it. We will hand in deeds for our houses as a surety to the bank and become guarantor that if the community can't pay, we will stay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very generous of them. They did it, and we acquired this school. It was because it was derelict, we had to do a lot of work ourselves to bring it to the standard where we can use it as a community center and a place of worship.
Mm-hmm.
And we carried on from then until 1992, where we started feeling a bit of a crunch. It was becoming too crowded because the building was old. It was costing us more in maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less what the fund we used to raise used to be consumed by maintenance, and very little was left for other charitable activities. So we said we'd rather now think what we want to do, whether we want to buy another place or perhaps develop this place. And it took us, we started doing feasibility studies and so on. By 1996, we came to the conclusion, or with help of the community, that we need a new center. So we decided to look around for a piece of land, perhaps. And we couldn't find the land that would accommodate all our activities and again remain in the center of the city where everybody can have access.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously we can get land, but we could get then by then, but it was out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to go out of the reach of local people.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to demolish the school and rebuild the center on the same place. So by 1997, we started talking to authorities and we applied for the lottery funding, and we got our lottery funding in 1998. And we were successful in building this new place.
Fantastic. Can you tell me just a bit about some of the activities and things that go on here, because it's a temple, but and like you say, it's also a community center. But can you tell me, you know, who it actually serves and what that happens here? Maybe.
Well, as I've said, that we started with a derelict school.
I'll just pause it for a second, so we can.
Right. Well, as you know, in 1975 we acquired the derelict building, we started the community center, and we had we converted one hall into a place of worship, and we converted other rooms into activity rooms where we started sports so that the children can come and play sports, badminton, etc., you know, weightlifting, whatever they want to do. We had a room for cultural activities where we can get boys and girls together and teach them our songs and psalms and how to play the stick dance and things like that, the plays. And we also use those rooms to teach mother tongue language. And I initiated a school, a Gujarati mother tongue school, in 1975 with 50 children. And by 1980, we had 250 children on the record, on roll.
Mm-hmm.
And we started running 7 classes. So we had to hire rooms from the neighboring schools at weekends to run those classes. So, and we registered ourselves as an examining center for GCSE, and all our pupils then can apply for GCSE in Gujarati.
Mm-hmm.
And our results are 100% from day one between A and C.
Mm-hmm. So all very good grades.
Very good. We also set up activity for elderly. We set up activities for women's group, and we also started doing charity work for local causes, like hospice and for hospitals and so on. And we raised funds, and we will give it away to charities and so on. So it's not just looking after our community, but our concern is also to be as helpful as others, to put our share of the contribution into the community at large and try and do our best.
Okay. Can I just ask you a few questions just about your religious practices over the years? I mean, Was your family a very religious family that you came from?
I would say most Hindus are all religious. It's hard to define whether they are very religious or, but come to certain days in the year, certain ceremonies and certain period of Lent and so on, all Hindus will try to observe that. And particularly my parents, my father, he was rather more conservative Hindu, and he used to practice it as much as he can. So I had an early influence from my parents of going to temples and worshipping and fasting and lenting and so on. So when we established this center, I made a place of worship. I was involved in selecting a priest from India, and we brought a priest. And since then, I've been involved in religious practices also. So I've developed my interest in religion and my practice, as well I've helped others. And yes, I'm a staunch Hindu. Although I'm liberal, there are things I'll not compromise as a Hindu.
Like what, for example?
Going to temple and after having a meal somewhere else, where perhaps, I don't know, but if there's a meat product involved or anything. So we don't consume meat products when we want to come here. Always have baths before we come here. Always observe the rules we have to before we enter the temple. Also preserve the sanctity of the center as a Hindu, and see that others do. So I have been very actively involved in promoting the practice of Hinduism, not by converting people, but by informing people. Because I have been involved in taking visits from schools and institutions and so on. And our objective has been that as Hindus, we want people to see what we are, what we do. And Hinduism is a very liberal religion. It teaches us to love people, to help people, rather than to hate because of the habits or the food or whatever. So, well, all right, it doesn't suit us, we keep away from it. But if it suits you, fine. But when we meet, we can talk on mutual grounds. You know, we can compromise certain things. You observe our rules and you're most welcome. So I would always talk to institutions and schools, and I think Hinduism is more about being good humans rather than being fanatic about certain rules of religion.
Yeah.
See? And I would say that you don't have to convert to Hinduism to become a Hindu. If you are informed, if you are convinced, and if you practice, you are always a Hindu. Because principle of Hinduism is to build one's knowledge of humanity so that one becomes a good human being. Because we are all humans. We are born as humans. We are not born with a religion. We are brought into religion. Or we just adopt a religion. So why fight about things we adopt or we are brought into? Why don't we conserve and think about humanism? Because we are all humans. We are born. We are not born with a religion. We are born as humans. And all religion teaches you one fundamental thing, is that's to become a good human. So that's the cause we are promoting here. And that's how I will promote Hinduism, rather than being fanatic about certain rituals or rules and say, well, you have done this and this. Okay, fine. If you have ignorantly come here with something, you know, we'll say, look, nicely, I will convince you, I'll talk to you, inform you, and say, this doesn't apply to us, we can't accept this, can we please next time observe this, you know. And that's the best way to deal with the problems, rather than being fanatic and taking offense. Because you don't improve things by taking offense. You can only improve things by informing and by convincing people. See, when people think about hatred, about racism, I mean, racism is something that's not given to you, nor you can take it from anybody. It's within you. It's your thoughts. But your thoughts can be influenced by other people's ideas and how they convince you. And we need to educate people that rather than hating racism, or rather hating individuals because they make racist comments or whatever, I would say make friends, talk to them, convince them. Try and make them think positively rather than negatively. And that can help you a lot in integrating and promoting good harmony within the community.
Can I ask you how you feel that you have developed maybe spiritually over the years?
Well, I think...
do you feel that you've changed?
It's hard to say because as people grow and their experience grow, people always change. And I think same thing has happened to me. There's nothing special about me.
Just a couple of general questions I want to ask you. The youth of today, do you feel that they are more or less religious than when you were a youth yourself?
Well, I would say that all youths, perhaps nowadays or when I was a youth, we would all have same sort of thoughts and attitudes towards culture and religion, whatever. But then again, the older people need to understand that the youth is the age where people are inquisitive and they're also rebellious because they may not understand the reasons behind it. And we need to talk to these people sensibly, calmly, and be sensitive to their thinking. So that once you start talking to them as a friend with open mind and make them understand the concept, I don't think the youths will then either conflict or go into rebellion, but they will want to know more, and perhaps once they get to know more, they will then be flexible to adjust themselves to perhaps the requirement that we want them to behave in or whatever. But I think it takes a lot of efforts to talk to youths and elders, particularly when they are agitated or aggravated due to some actions. They need to remain calm and think and perhaps, calm down, bring those youths, talk to them as friends. It can help. And in my case, I have done that, and I've got good results.
Another topic that people often ask questions about and are confused over is the caste system. Do you feel that that's still present in the UK today, and does it have any relevance?
Let me tell you, the people have come from India, and they brought these values with them of caste system. But if you look back now, in India, the caste system is dying there. There are a lot of intercaste marriages happening, and even more in here nowadays. So I think the caste system is now dying. Rarely you might see some people who are adamant or very obsessive, but very rarely it comes out nowadays. People have changed their ideas. Not that they have perhaps lived in Western country for 40, 50 years. I mean, they know what their generation is like and what future generations will be. We can preserve the values of our culture and religion, but we cannot preserve the systems that we brought here, because the system keeps changing every so often as new things come into existence, technically, culturally, and so on. And all systems and traditions are bound to change or die. So I will not be surprised in the 20 years India will not have a caste system at all. And perhaps here also people stop talking about caste.
How do you feel that the Hindu community has changed then over the years? It's really established itself in the UK. So maybe 30, 40 years.
How do you feel it's
progressed? And also, how do you feel that things could change to help even more progression?
Well, Hinduism has progressed greatly in England now. There are so many temples, and I've lost the counts now. They are nearly 200 temples. You see, the religion here has prospered a lot. In comparison to India, I think the people here are more religious, more conservative religiously and culturally. At the same time, they have become more liberal in mixing and integrating with the host community. And they are standing on similar level now, where you see they can compete with host community and perhaps prove themselves even better. So I can see they will prosper, they will progress, and the religion and the culture will also prosper, it won't die. Yes, the technically there might be some changes, they'll start using new things perhaps. They may work within the original boundaries of religion with a new theme. But that happens. Because if you go back to thousands of years and look at the Christianity or look at the Hinduism or look at the Islam, it's been changing, it's been evolving. The things change with the time. So I don't think people should worry too much about it. Because your lifespan is so many years. I mean, I can live to 60, 70, 80 or 90 years. And I go. So what does it matter to me? To me, what matters is I must do my duty towards my religion, my culture, and my community, my people, to do all my best to help them to progress and prosper in peace and harmony. And that should satisfy me. I'm not bothered what happens after another 100 years, because the community, other people will come and they will take charge and they will be as much responsible, I think, and I hope they will be, and do their best. So rather than worrying about it, why not improve the present? My idea is, do not dwell in past and do not get lost in future, but dwell in present. And if you improve your presence, your future will be bright.
A couple of final questions now. If somebody was to ask you, who are you, how would you identify yourself now? Because you were brought up in Africa, lived there for such a long time, but born in India, lived in the UK for a very long time, very strong Hindu as well. So if somebody was to say, who are you, what would you say?
Well, let me tell you. First of all, I am a Hindu. As a religious person, but before that, I'm a human. So I'm a human being practicing Hinduism. I'm British subject living in England. So I domicile in England. And I would say, this is my country, this is my home. And as far as my religion and culture is concerned, I would say I'm quite happy. I have preserved it, I have conserved it, I have passed it to my future generations, and I think I'm quite happy to see it prosper. And as a Hindu and as a human, I would say all humans should satisfy after doing their giving their contribution to their community, to their religion and culture, watch it and be happy with it, rather than be sad about future or past.
My next question was going to be, where do you see as home now? But I think you've already answered that.
Well, let me say one thing. You cannot live in England and call yourself an Indian. Yes, I'm originally Indian, but now I'm British. I'm British Hindu. So my domicile is here. My loyalty is to this country. I must not get involved in Indian politics because it won't help me. I can sympathize with them up to a level, but then there's a limit what I can do. But I can do best for my country, this country where I live.
Do you ever go back to India?
I visit India every few years to see my relatives, and I made so many friends. I enjoy the weather there, I enjoy the food there, but it's like a holiday place for me.
Yeah.
Now
you don't feel an attachment?
Well, let me tell you one thing. Once you live abroad from home for so many years, although the country in England we are called foreigners, if I go back, I'll be called foreigners there, right? So I'd rather be a foreigner in my country of where I've domiciled, where I've lived, than the country I've left.
Finally then, do you have any final message or thought to give to people who will be listening in the future?
Well, I would say, if people call themselves human, then they must learn the values of being a human being, preserve it, conserve it, follow the whatever faith they are in, follow the teaching of the faith with open mind, with understanding, and take the values that will help you and others, rather than being fundamental and restricting yourself in prosperity and progress. Because if you restrict others, you're also restricting yourself.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.